Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Why do people go to church? That question might seem rather banal, but it is worth asking in light of a new finding from a Barna Group survey. That survey found that almost 50% of regularly attending American churchgoers say that their lives haven't changed in any way as a result of their churchgoing habits. 50%! That same survey found that roughly 60% said that they could not recall an important new religious insight from the last time they attended church, and 50% couldn't remember any insight from the previous week's service. Wow! I mean, what's up with that? If going to church doesn't seem to make an appreciable difference in the lives of half of Americans' congregants, and 60% could not even remember anything important they learned, why are these people bothering to drag themselves out of bed, get in their Sunday go-to-meeting clothes, and, at least for us folks out here on the West Coast, give up time away from Sunday morning football games played on the East Coast? My guest today, Professor Richard Florey, recently blogged about this topic, and since he just became my Facebook friend, I figured, what the heck, let's get him on the show and talk about this. Richard is an associate research professor of sociology at the University of Southern California, and serves as director of research at the USC Center for Religion and Civic Culture. He is the author of several books, including Growing Up in America, The Power of Race in the Lives of Teens, Finding Faith, The Spiritual Quest of the Post-Boomer Generation, and Gen X Religion. His current research is focused on several projects that investigate the role of religion and religious institutions in the civic life of Los Angeles, which we also hope to talk about here after we figure out why these people are going to church. As usual, I will link to his blog posting and books on our website so y'all can take a look at it. And while you're there, I will also ask you to click the Facebook logo on the right-hand side of our webpage and become our friend because, well, we'll keep you up to date on the doings and happenings here on the podcast. Richard, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
So let's talk about this finding from Barna. And first, I should note that the guy who heads up Barna was one of your former students. Is that correct?
Yes, he was.
And so do you get special insights for that?
No, I don't, although I am in contact with him off and on.
Okay.
So I'm trying to move him. He's a psychology major as an undergrad, and so I'm trying to move him in a sociological way.
Okay. Well, that's good. Yeah. So, well, anyways, the survey. About 50% of people who are regular churchgoers do not believe that attending religious services is having any impact on their lives. And these are regular churchgoers, not just the folks who show up on Christmas and Easter. Now, when I read that, it first surprised me, and I'm sure it came as a shock to a lot of clergy out there as well. But then I started thinking about this a little bit further, and, well, 50% of people who are not having any type of impact in that, well, that also means, on the other hand, that at least 50% of regular churchgoers do feel that church is making a difference. So that seems pretty good. What's your initial reaction when you saw this finding?
Well, my initial response is really sort of reflected in what I titled the post. Like, why even bother if that's the net effect? But then again, as you noted, you know, half the respondents do say they get something out of it. But most of the comments I read that were related to the report from the Barna website were that, you know, they were focused on the negative side of this equation, that all the people that aren't getting anything out of it because of going to church.
Yeah, is there any sense that this is a recent trend, or, you know, was this the case 50 years ago? Do we have any sense of that?
Yeah, it's not contextualized historically, and so there's a lot more that we don't know than what we do know from the findings that they've presented. And I have not seen the data, so I don't really know. They're a, I think, a for-profit company, so I'm sure they're checking their data.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the other stunning finding here is that 60% didn't learn anything new from recent church services, and that 50% couldn't even remember what happened last week in the pews. And they're like, whoa. I mean, this actually sounds like my political economy students, right? If they've taken micro econ 101 and they received at least a B in the course, they feel they're entitled to a Nobel Prize, and there isn't any more I can teach them. So they just kind of tune out, or, you know, unless there's a test coming up soon, they are going to be watching YouTube while I lecture. So what do you think is going on here that people can't remember what happened last week in church?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, sort of following your line about your students, I mean, it might reflect an overblown view of our own abilities as teachers, and whether we're teachers or preachers. But I think that something else is going on here, and it may be framed around the way that the questions are worded and how people think about going to church. And that has to do with that. I think in a lot of cases, people tend to think of church like some big classroom where the pastor is going to be engaging and thoughtful and is always going to be able to deliver some sort of significant pearls of wisdom. But, you know, how realistic is that? I mean, the most engaging person will fail at some point. So my hunch is that most pastors aren't the big charismatic types that we get to see on television or whatever. But I think there's probably an expectation issue, and there's probably a sort of how do we understand what the question means issue going on with the people they asked.
Yeah, and I guess part of it, too, might be the fact that you go through biblical stories that you've heard since you were a kid in Sunday school, and you say, oh, yeah, you know, the Sermon on the Mount, heard that one before. And I'm wondering if when you ask somebody, hey, did you learn anything new? So, no, we learned Sermon on the Mount. I heard that a while before. Blessed are the poor, got it. But I don't know, maybe at some points in time, something, a different spark goes off in your brain, but people don't recognize it.
Yeah, it's hard to know because, like I said, I haven't actually seen that data. I've seen their report, and it's, you know, the way it was framed is, you know, did you get anything out of it? Has it impacted your life? Those kinds of questions.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty general question to ask about weekly or monthly church attendance.
Yeah, the other thing I was thinking about, too, is the demographic breakdown. I don't know if you've seen anything on that. You know, for instance, it just might be the case, since this is a 50% number here, that we're just picking up the responses from a lot of bored husbands who were dragged to church by their wives and, you know, who actually spend a lot of their time on their smartphones seeing who's up in the latest college basketball polls. Because we know sociologically, women tend to be much more engaged in religion and tend to be much more religious on average than men. And, you know, if a lot of married folks are going there, half the population is going to be there against their will to some extent. Any ideas on that?
Well, it's funny. It reminds me of my father was a pastor when I was growing up. And so when I was, you know, like elementary school, there was this one guy in this small church my dad had. And literally everybody in the church thought he was hard of hearing. Well, it turns out that he was listening to the Dodger games. So I think you may not be far off.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, they don't report any gender breakdown of the respondents, and they also what's also missing are race and ethnic breakdowns. And I would be interested in that. I would be interested in the gender, and I would also be interested in differences between race and ethnicity. You know, some of the stuff we've done, particularly the teenagers and race book, we did, and there's a chapter on religion, and it shouldn't be too much of a surprise. But African American kids, this is kids. We're going to follow this up with a Wave 3 study, but they're coming once we get organized. But that the African American kids are by far the most religious, and the religion of institution, their churches, etc., have much more significant place in their lives than white kids, for example, and Latino kids kind of are more similar to black kids than to white kids. So the racial element is missing there as well. What they did report, and I think this is something that I'm not sure how it fits in the corporate strategy of Barna, but I think a lot of churches are interested in this, is they reported on generational data, and I think there's lots of problems with generational approaches in general, even though we've written things about that. But looking at the numbers they report, it's interesting that the youngest group, which they have is 18 to 27, shows the least percentage of people getting something out of church. So as you move up the age range, you tend to get more meaning or whatever out of your your church experience. And that was true across all the different majors that they had.
That's perfectly consistent with my expectations of raising a pre-teenager because they know everything.
Right.
And, you know, as you get older and older, I'm finding out I know less and less. So some of this stuff is like oozing out of my ears. Since you've done work on this generational issue, let's take a side trip here and, mm-hmm. and talk a little bit about that. As you saw the generational breakdown that Barna gives for this, the 18 to what 25 year olds or so are the ones who tend to get the least amount out of going to church services. And then again, one would have to wonder why are they there? Because they have so many other opportunities to be hanging out. When you get old, you don't have anything else to do but go to church on Sunday, I guess. You know, on Saturday night, you know, you're at home, you know, hoping you can get to bed by 8 o'clock, but they're out partying and having a good time. So how does one get teenagers or young adults into church and, how do you get a message across to them? What have you found in your research?
Well, what we've found is that in a couple of different ways, and I think their age range is 18 to 27, which is, you know, that includes freshmen in college to people that have been in a career for probably 5 years or so, and so it's a pretty broad range of life experience. But what we found, we had a project a few years ago where we looked at Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, and Muslim young adult programs that were thriving in L.A., New York, and Chicago. And across the board, across geographic region, across religious tradition, the groups that were doing well and were the ones where the young people had ownership, where they had a place to be, where they felt like they were actually part of the church as opposed to the sort of, oh yeah, you're young and you do your thing, we won't really, but they felt really involved in the larger activities of the church, whatever those were, and that ranged from, you know, outreach activities to singing in the choir to whatever. So I think that's a big piece of it, where they can feel that they really have some sort of ownership in whatever congregation they're participating in and feel valued for their presence there.
Well, let me ask you that, because a lot of strategies or a lot of tactics that churches employ are, we're going to create a youth ministry, so we ship them off to another part of the building or even another building entirely,
right.
And you do that youth group. That's not what we're talking here. It sounds like that they need to be engaged with the adult congregation. Is that what you found?
That's what we've seen in several and actually more than one study that we've done, where they, you know, the more they feel like they're a part of what's going on and taken seriously too, not just placated or whatever, but, you know, their idea, I mean, you know, like they're 18 to whatever, and they should be thinking crazy thoughts at that age, I'm assuming, you know, but to be able to engage those thoughts, engage them in a realistic way such that they can feel an actual part of the congregation, as opposed to, and this is exactly how I grew up, you did your own thing, you sort of had to go to morning service, but you didn't, you know, you kind of hit out and drew comics and whatever.
Yeah, yeah. You know? No, I remember growing up in a Catholic church, and they had a special sheltered off room for crying kids. And that it kind of permeated to the middle school kids, you know, when you're 10, 11, 12 year olds, that, you know, they weren't really talking to me.
Right.
And then later on, if you went to confirmation class or Sunday school or something, you went to a different place and, you know, your parents came by and picked you up and you didn't know what was going on in the regular sanctuary or anything. So
I kind of think it's interesting. I mean, it's probably a pretty simple principle, which is if you expect something from somebody, they'll probably, on average, rise to that occasion, whatever it is. And if the expectation is that you should engage with us here because this is what this religious community is, then more often than not, you'll probably get a better engagement from younger people.
Yeah, no, that's probably true.
We could test that. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's actually true.
Well, talking about engagement, too, I want to return back to this question of the 50% of the folks that are not getting anything out of church and toss out another explanation here. And you've had a chance to think about these things, but, you know, what about the natural ebbs and flows of religious life? Because I'll confess here that there are times that I am not really engaged in the pastor's sermon. And we have a pretty dynamic pastor at our church now and very engaging, but, you know, sometimes I've been out camping the night before or at a party with some friends and, you know, I'm really tired and, you know, so I'm just not paying attention. And there are times too that, you know, you go through periods of doubt and you're there and you're sitting, wow, why am I really here? And your mind starts to wander. I mean, if half the congregation is like that at any given time, I'm not surprised that you didn't catch what was going on.
Right. And I think that's an inherent issue of a sort of one point in time survey. You don't catch those kinds of processes that people go through. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the more you talk to them, most of our work is this qualitative interview, ethnographic kind of work. And the more you talk to people, the more you get them to tell you about their lives, you get to see those sorts of, you know, processes that they're going through throughout their life, where they're on, you know, in the parlance, they're on fire at one point, but they're pretty doubtful at another point, and they don't care at another point. And I think, too, like what you suggest, you know, you're tired, whatever, it catches them at a not only is it a one point in time survey, but the individuals are experiencing particular things at that point in time when they've been asked that question. So that may be driving what they're answering. I mean, they could be annoyed, they could be distracted, they could be tired, they may not particularly feel that great about their church at that point in time. So there's any number of ways to wonder about that number. I think, you know, I've been involved in the National Study of Youth and Religion Survey that Christmas has been running for several years now, and what's promising about that, and although they're still going to be in their 20s, the fourth wave, I think, I'm not sure when it's going out, but so they started, that survey started when they were 13 to 17. Now they'll all be post-college age, whether they went to college or not, and into their sort of early career, so we should be able to kind of track, and I know Chris is doing that on the sort of larger religion side with that study.
Chris who?
Chris, huh?
Chris who?
Chris Smith.
Oh, Christian Smith over at Notre Dame, yeah.
Yes, and so, you know, but those studies are rare, unfortunately. That, you know, there's not a lot of money to do a sort of longitudinal study where you're looking at the same people over time that's actually representative of the population. So those kinds of things are valuable, but we're missing that in something like the study that Barna's done.
Yeah, no, I can see how, you know, if 50% of the congregation at one time is distracted, tired, aggravated for some reason, and that happens once out of every 4 weeks or something. You're still talking about a population that 3 out of 4 times is actually doing pretty good, but you know, you just happen to catch those folks at that time that they weren't paying attention. So,
right, and you have to, I mean, again, back to the beginning where, you know, it's like, what's the point anyway if you're not getting anything out of it? Clearly they're getting something out of it, or why would you keep going?
Yeah.
And so that's sort of what I would be curious about. And if the stuff that Barna has reported as made available is that there are other things they get out of going to church. They may not remember a particular, you know, point or whatever, but they do get a feeling of belonging, and they're there with people that care about them and things like that. So there are other reasons that they talk about it, but that, or at least responded, that it's valuable for church going.
Well, let me come back to that, because I want you to expand upon that. But I have another theory or hypothesis to toss out here that may reflect not so much the church-going population, but the clergy, because there's two sides of the podium. There's two sides of the lectern. You have the congregants who may not be paying attention, but you might have the clergy who, you know, could be kind of boring. And I know when surveys like this come out, when the American Religious Identification Survey came out and said, oh, a lot more people say that, you know, they're nuns, they're not religious. I get calls from clergy saying, oh my gosh, America's going to hell in a handbasket, and nobody's religious anymore, and you know, the fires of hell are burning through the culture. And I'm saying, no, you just put it into a bigger context here. And I can only imagine that when this Barna survey came out, the clergy just were freaked out. And you know, initial reaction is say, well, what's wrong with those congregants? But the second reaction says, hey, what are we doing as clergy? Are we dull? Or, you know, I've been to a number of different churches. As I mentioned before, the church that I attend now has an extremely dynamic pastor. So he does keep you engaged. He's funny. They use multimedia, and it's great. But, you know, about a year ago, I was at an Old Line Presbyterian church out in Princeton, and I mean, I couldn't stay awake for this entire thing. And I honestly could not tell you what went on other than, you know, there were some folks up there in robes and we sang hymns. And that whenever I raised my hands to sing a hymn, everybody stared at me and say, you're a little bit too dynamic there, son. So could it be the pastorate?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny you mentioned the Presbyterians. I was in New York about a year ago to visit a congregation there that is related to the Dream Center out here, and I talked to a youth group leader that was there with his youth group, which was from a Presbyterian church, I think in Kansas City or something, and he said, "Oh yeah, we're the Frozen Chosen." I just started laughing. It may be that there's sort of too much of that kind of entertainment expectation put on pastors, and you know, I mean, I understand it. I mean, people go to church, they want to get an authoritative word from the pulpit, and I totally understand that. But I think that thinking about church more broadly in terms of the whole worship experience, my hunch is that the church you go to is probably overall more dynamic than the church you went to in Princeton. That there's a lot more going on, there's a lot more involvement of you in the service. You're not there. I mean, one way I've thought about this is some churches you go to, you are quite literally a spectator, and other churches you are a full participant in what's going on. And if you don't participate, you are the outlier. And so I think, you know, my hunch is that your experience reminds me of when I was in grad school in Chicago. We went to a Presbyterian church downtown, and the ushers seemed like flight attendants. They had to bring everybody down front because it was such a big sanctuary and there was nobody there. And it was a really, and they had, you know, the white gloves and everything. And it was a really undynamic service, if that's the word. And such that they felt compelled to pull everybody down front because they were afraid everybody would sit in the back and maybe leave early. I don't know. But anyway, all that to say, I think, you know, the thinking more overall about what's going on. And I think, you know, I mean, I think the onus is on churches in some ways, whether for good or ill, to figure out ways to adapt to changing times. I mean, things happen all the time. And look, the Presbyterians, and the Episcopalians for that matter, unless they manage to adapt and bring in new generations of interested people, they're not going to last a lot longer.
Yeah. Well, that's true. Well, I want to return back to what you were saying is people must be going for some reason. If it's not getting that message out or remembering what happened last Sunday and they still return, either they're, you know, robotic zombie drones or there's something else going on here. And in your blog post, you said something that was really kind of interesting. And again, I had the same experience here, but you have a different take on it. You mentioned that your Sunday school teacher a long time ago said that church wasn't social hour. But then you said, maybe she's wrong. Maybe it is. Explain that.
Well, it wasn't one. I mean, I think every Sunday school teacher we had growing up, was the emphasis. Like, you're not here to have fun. You're here to learn.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know? And so you're not here to see your friends, you know. And but I think to separate that out is problematic. I mean, part of going to anything like that, and probably particularly church, is about being with people that are like you on some fundamental level. And if those kinds of friendships and relationships aren't encouraged and developed, then to me, it's like, what's the point? I mean, so I have another, I guess that's my perspective on what's the point. So, but I think it's at root, it's religion is social, it's communal, no matter what. And even to the point of, I think in that blog, I likened my experience going surfing to, you know, that could be framed as some sort of individual spiritual experience. But even the category for me to think about that is coming from someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's just, oh, yeah, there's a dolphin floating by. And I don't have that sort of experience with that. And in fact, even in that case, the first thing that happens to anybody I know that experiences that surfing is they look around to talk to somebody else. They don't keep it to themselves. It's not like, oh, yeah, a dolphin just went by. That was cool. It was like, did you just see that? And so you want to involve yourself with somebody else. So I think that's a natural thing, and I think that's probably not a bad thing for churches to emphasize. And that people get something out of just being around other people that are like them, at least in some ways.
That's a really interesting observation, because when I talk to a lot of students, younger folks, and they often tell me that, oh, yeah, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. And when I probe that a little bit further, they mean that, you know, I do the God thing by myself. It's a private thing, and I don't need to go to some institution or some four walls every Sunday to do that religious thing. But I often wonder, you know, how good they are at keeping up with that. It's kind of like an exercise routine that if you don't have somebody there as an accountability partner motivating you, you tend to backslide. And that aspect of sociability becomes, you know, incredibly important. As you say, you know, when you're out surfing, you see some dolphins, you're looking for somebody. There has to be something that you share there. I have the same moment when I eat Dairy Queen blizzards. You know, you're out there surfing me. I just have, you know, cookie dough blizzard. I'm like, oh man, you got to come and try this. And, you know, so I
still a social thing. This tastes so good, right?
Yeah. No, I don't share it with anybody. I just tell them about it.
Yeah. But, well, that way of sharing.
Yeah. But, you know, and that is interesting because if you think about church, right, this is, and you think about the typical Sunday morning meeting that, you know, Christians do throughout the country, it's a different type of communal activity than people are used to during the regular week. You know, usually your communal activity involves people that you're working with, you're task oriented, getting paid. Maybe you like your work, maybe you don't like your work, or, you know, you're at school, or then there's some kind of, you know, maybe social event or party that you might attend on Friday or Saturday night. But the one on Sunday, I mean, that's a different time. You're not there to party. It's a much more, you know, in part serious mood that this is about something transcendent and eternal. And you're sharing that with people who are not your coworkers, and it's an opportunity to be equal with everybody else at a certain point in time. And that's kind of a neat thing.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's important. I mean, you know, I don't see how, and I'm sure there are other ways that people share things like that, but I mean, you know, in religious realm, that is a key part of people's identity, and they want to be able to share it with other people. And I think being on your own, I mean, I think even that category of spiritual but not religious, I think that's a sort of learned category that people present. And even that suggests that there's some sort of amorphous community of like types of people. I'm like those people, but I'm not like those people that actually go inside that church building. And I'm not equating those, I'm not sure what that actually means when people say that.
Yeah. Well, talking about this communitarian aspect, I want to direct our conversation now to some of the work that you've been doing on churches that do get involved in the community, that go outwards and try to engage the wider population. And I want to do that through the conduit of another blog post that you wrote a few days after the piece on why people go to church. And there you were talking about your experience of attending a Biola chapel service. And for those listeners who are not familiar with Biola, it used to be called the Bible Institute of Los Angeles. And I think that is still the official name, or I don't know if the acronym Biola now is their official name.
Yeah, the acronym is the official name. I think they actually changed it to that in the 50s, early 60s, but they maintained the name because of the historic, you know, connection.
Okay, I guess I'm a little bit behind the times there. anyways, you used to work at Biola, is that correct?
I did. Not only did I work there, I went there and my dad taught there for like 30 plus years. So.
Wow. And one of the things that you mentioned in this blog post is that you never attended a chapel service until mid-February of 2012. So what's up with that?
Yeah, and I haven't been there. I haven't worked there in several years. Well, the larger story is, you know, I grew up in that environment. I mean, like I said, my dad taught there for 30 plus years. And it's sort of like when you're a little kid, you have to do things because your parents tell you to. So I had to go to that school and all that. Not that it was all bad. It was just typical youth rebellion kind of thing. And so as a student there, my memory is I didn't go to that many chapels either. And largely it was because of what I experienced when I taught there. And when I came back, I was quite different than when I took to teach there. And I wasn't planning on coming back. But the chapels were the usual suspects. They were generally probably 90% or more were white men that were generally given a pep talk on why Christianity was true. Well, that's kind of boring and irrelevant. I mean, it's like what we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to have required chapel for students, at least make it worth their while to show up. And from my view, I could hardly see that it was worth their while. Now, I'm not saying that it's not for everybody, but for me, I would look at the chapel schedule and not be interested in it. Then I just quit looking at the chapel schedule. So, I mean, it's just sort of, you know, bad behavior begets bad behavior.
Yeah. Well, then you went back in mid-February, and here's what you wrote from your blog. If chapels had been like today's, maybe I would have been a regular. Well, at least I would have attended when the speaker was someone like Reverend Mark Whitlock, who preached today. Who's this Mark Whitlock guy? Why did you say that you'd really love to go back to chapel if he's preaching?
Mark is a friend of mine and colleague of mine, and Mark is an African American man who has an AME church in Irvine, and if you're familiar with LA at all, that's kind of an anomaly in itself.
Yeah, it is, because Irvine is kind of the white bread southernmost suburb of Los Angeles in regard. Yeah, I used to live down there.
Yeah, so and the funny thing is Irvine is actually quite ethnically diverse, but it just doesn't have any African Americans living in it. So you have a lot of immigrants, you know, South Asian and East Asian immigrants and things like that, but there's not much in the way of African Americans. But nonetheless, he's been very successful, and that church is, you know, 2,500 members now. And so I went just because I knew he was going to go there, and he had talked to me about it. But yeah, I'll go. So it was fun to see him in that environment, and the chapel itself was probably the most. It wasn't like the whole student body. It was probably 400 or so people that were in there. It was probably the most diverse chapel service that you would have. It's kind of oriented around those sorts of things, and they have them, I don't know, weekly or whatever. From my perspective, I mean, when I was a student at Biola, the one chapel that I could literally point to that had an influence on my life was an African American preacher, one of the few that ever at that point showed up there, that challenged me in a way that I hadn't been challenged before. But it also was because I was thinking about doing things in a somewhat. I wanted to quote do something in the city, whatever that meant. I had no idea what that meant. And he came and spoke, and he kind of laid, you know, said, "Oh, from my view." Sort of challenged me, not that I ever met him, but I just saw that yesterday as a similar sort of experience. Plus, it was fun to watch Mark preach, and I hadn't heard him preach before, but just seeing and experiencing him in that environment was fun, and it was also fun to watch the students experience that as well. Some were a little bit like, wow, what is going on here, and others were just into it, regardless of race or ethnicity, so...
Yeah, you brought up in that blog post how Reverend Whitlock challenged students to get active in the community, and how many evangelicals today, especially the younger ones, are seeking new ways to engage, I don't know, quote unquote, the real world, rather than living in their protective institutional clamshell known as a church. But my question for you is, doesn't every generation say that? And is that something new that Reverend Whitlock is tapping into nowadays, or what?
Well, that's funny too, because I think there's a lot of kind of chatter about this newer generation of evangelicals, and they're becoming more socially aware, et cetera, et cetera. And it sort of belies a larger history of evangelicalism and Christianity in general in the U.S. But I think minimally it does sort of address what's gone on within evangelical circles over the last 30 or so years, where it's become overtly right-wing Republican religious right kind of thing, and that if you don't buy that party line, you're sort of an outlier. But I mean, you can go back to the early 70s and Jim Wallace and Sojourners was getting started, and you can go back to the 40s and I'm blanking on his name right now. An evangelical theologian, Carl Henry, was writing about the uneasy conscience of American fundamentalism, which at that time meant evangelicalism, because it had essentially lost its social conscience. So there's obviously always a much larger history. And I'm also cautious when I think about, is this really, first of all, is it new? I don't think it's necessarily new. Is it going on? It kind of remains to be seen. But I think there are signs of something that's going on. And I'm wondering, and I'm not sure about this, and I certainly haven't done a study on it yet, but in the 80s, James Hunter wrote a book called Evangelicalism, The Coming Generation, and the sort of short argument he makes is that evangelicalism is secularizing, and it's secularizing from the inside out through their leading colleges. essentially education is leading the way to the demise of evangelicalism. Well, I think that there, I'd like to figure this out. I think there is an educational effect, but I don't think it's necessarily secularizing. I think it's broadening them where they don't want to give up their faith, but they want to figure out ways to express it in other ways than what's been available to them, certainly in their lifetime. So that's sort of where I think Mark's sermon could, and similar sorts of things like that could come into play with younger evangelicals, not unlike in my life when I had a guy, and he's since passed away several years ago. I never met him, but he had, because of that exposure, that sort of influence in me to where I ended up teaching, believe this or not, out of college, I'm 6'5", and I was teaching second grade in South Central LA. So it was kind of interesting.
Well, this discussion brings me up to your current research, how, you know, evangelicals may not be secularizing from the inside, but seeking to broaden their approach to become more relevant. And you know, talk about folks like Jim Wallace, who are saying what we need to do is get out and engage the community. You have been involved in a research project that's been looking at religious communities in Los Angeles and how they interact with the communities over the past two decades. Actually, you start your timeline at the riots of 1992. And as someone who was in Los Angeles in 1992, I was living in Studio City at the time and experienced the riots firsthand. I really do understand where you're coming from when you choose that year as a starting marker and why it's considered to be a watershed moment in Los Angeles history. But perhaps you should fill in the folks not familiar with what went on during that time. What caused the riots, and why did this prompt churches to start rethinking the way that they did their religious business?
Yeah, I mean, the sort of public face of the impetus to the conflict was the Rodney King verdict that came out, where, if everybody remembers, Rodney King was beaten almost to death, it seemed, and it was photographed by some LAPD officers. And then they went on trial, and then they were essentially acquitted. But that was really the match that lit the gasoline of the underlying conflict, which really was, I think, rooted in this rapid demographic change, immigration. The areas that were in South LA that were most affected by the riots and the violence were. So this was 92. In the early 80s, I was, like I said, I was teaching school in South LA. That area was almost completely African American, and some of the people that I would talk with there were talking African Americans that were talking about, well, the Latinos are starting to move in, and we have to learn how to get along. You know, 12, 15 years later, the dominant racial group was ethnic group was Latino, and it was, and I hadn't been around. I drove through the area, and when I first came back to LA in the early 90s, and I was stunned at the difference. That just in who was living there. So that kind of, you know, where you, that sort of rapid change, and then the perceived and actual loss of economic opportunities for people. There was also a complicit in this was Daryl Gates and the police. They actually exited those neighborhoods when the violence started and just let it burn.
Yep.
And frankly, some of those neighborhoods had not recovered since 1965 and the Watts riots in 1965. So there's a lot of backdrop to what was going on at that point in time, and then in terms of the religious community's involvement and that as an impetus for them to act, they actually were working before the verdicts came down. Reverend Cecil Murray from First AME became really the public voice of calm, reason, and the moral authority in the face of all that social chaos. He had already been organizing congregations and religious leaders before the verdicts to try to counteract what he figured would happen if they came down the way that they did. And so they were calling, you know, they were trying to do their best, but, you know, things erupted. But then that then laid some groundwork for all the activities afterwards that were faith, lots of different community and faith groups came together. First of all, the framing of it was, you know, a lot of the effort was to just clean up the areas and things like that. But then it was, you know, let's heal the city, let's bring the city back together, let's heal the divisions, those sorts of things. So there were a lot of informal and formal relationships that were developed. And so a pastor would go to, a pastor from a Christian church would go to a Jewish congregation and preach, and then they would switch, and then a choir from an African-American church would go to a white Episcopal church. You know, they would switch things around to try to broaden the horizons of people. Most of those things died out within probably 3 years, but it laid the groundwork for lots of other things that developed since that time. And then there were external factors such as Clinton's Welfare Reform Act, and then which paved the way for, you know, the Bush and Obama faith-based issues and things like that, which then, all of which sort of opened, it wasn't that they weren't available before, but it allowed people to know from faith communities that they could participate in a much broader way in public.
Now, there's a lot of stuff going on there that you were just talking about. In the paper that I recently read from you, you divide some of this stuff out. You say, okay, initially churches reacted just to calm the storm that was there. But then once the embers of the fire died down, there was a five-pronged strategy, or at least there were five different ways that churches responded. And you talk about charity, organizing, advocacy, community develop, and then interfaith dialogue. So let's go ahead and do a little survey here of what each of these components represents and how effective they've been. Starting with charity, when you talk about churches getting involved in charity after 1992, what does that mean? Is that short-term charity, let's just, you know, pick up the pieces and the glass from the shattered buildings, or is it something more long-term?
Well, I think a lot of it's long-term, and some of it is has developed into other kinds of relationships. But in general, it's kind of the sweet spot that most faith groups participate in anyway. Some that, you know, people are aware of in any big urban area, there's usually a rescue mission of some sort or another that's faith-based. And so that's that sort of thing where it's provision of clothing, food, short-term shelter, et cetera, trying to help people out. One of the interesting outcomes of this from 92 was several, they were actually Lutheran churches, several Lutheran churches that hadn't really, other than a denominational, you know, identity, they didn't really do stuff together, but they created what they called New Parish. And that ultimately, to provide sort of charity sorts of things, but then it sort of morphed over the last 20 years into a broader based kind of community organization that's rooted in the nine, I think it's nine congregations that make it up. So it's both short term, but they're things that tend to last over time.
And now, is this the thing that gets the boost from Clinton's Charitable Choice Initiative, and then later on the faith based initiative of both Bush and the Obama administrations?
Well, I think that, and then really community development gets a lot of stuff from that. That there are opportunities available for people to create programming within communities. Whether it's and charity is actually not the best word. We struggled over a what was the best category for that would be, because it sort of involves all that sort of stuff. But the idea is, so the faith-based and Clinton and that is really around figuring out ways for faith communities to enter the public sphere and compete for dollars with other non-faith-based groups to provide whatever those needs are. So that kind of, that may fall in charity, that may fall in something called like community development. I actually worked with a fellow who had his, he had a it was a business in South LA, and it was really about mentoring young people. And I can't remember how I got to know him, but he wanted to do something out of this. It was right in the mid 90s, in the middle of what that Clinton Welfare to Work program was going on, and it was really about getting different churches and other congregations to develop child care programs and be able to apply to the state of California for funding for those programs. And then the idea was, if you can somehow care for the children of people, then that will free them up to be able to go to work, and because there's all these other things going on. Well, it ultimately didn't work because people were afraid of the red tape. The churches were afraid of the red tape. But that was the sort of the beginnings of people figuring out that they could be a part of the larger scheme of things in the city and in the region and utilize public funds. With the proper caveat that they can't proselytize and things like that.
Right. So that's what you mean by the community development aspect. It's a little bit more than
that. But also community development, like, housing development, okay. You know, for affordable housing, some for elders, others were for job development. There were a few community development and economic development corporations in Los Angeles that that are specifically associated with congregations that that flourished, that it came out of this. In fact, the one that came directly out of 1992 was run by Mark Whitlock. And he and Chip Murray from First AME, so it was called FAME Renaissance. First AME Renaissance is about rebuilding that community. And Mark, I think, from what he says, they ran like $400 million worth of programming through FAME Renaissance, which included, you know, working relationships with corporations, with state funding, different things like that to create jobs, to create transportation opportunities to jobs. They had taxi vouchers. They had, I think they worked a deal with Disney for jobs and transportation to Anaheim from Los Angeles for the jobs. So there's a lot of different things that the community development and economic development groups have done that includes programming and job creation and things like that.
And how successful has that been? I mean, it sounds like it's been pretty successful. You got $400 million pumping through it.
Yeah, that FAME Renaissance has had some problems, and the AME Church apparently requires their pastors to retire at 75. So Chip Murray had to retire at 75, and Mark, I think, left there at that time, and or maybe before. I can't remember exactly the timeline. And so Mark started his own church, and since that time, they're still a presence, but they're not nearly as powerful as they were. And the one that's the most powerful now in the LA area is probably West Angeles Church of God in Christ, West Angeles Community Development Corporation, and they have developed, you know, it's a separate entity from the church, but it's sponsored by the church and it's driven by their values and things like that. So it's partly about developing young people into leaders. It's partly about creating affordable housing and trying to work with other community groups to create jobs and things like that. So they and there are others as well. Those aren't the only two. They're ongoing, and I think they ebb and flow, probably dependent on their leadership. I know West Angeles CDC has recently, the woman who founded that, Lula Balton is her name, she retired, but she's now working for the overall Church of God in Christ Community Development Corporation, and there's somebody else has taken that over, but it seems to still, it's made the transition well.
Mm-hmm.
FAME Renaissance, not so much.
Yeah. I guess that tells you a lot about the importance of leadership that is here. It's difficult to perhaps institutionalize some of these things that that it would carry on past the passing or the retiring of a leader.
Well, it is, and that's one of the things that we've discovered in a lot of our work that we in the Center for Religion and Civic Culture, we do sort of like this straight up research, but we also have these more programmatic kinds of things that we do. And we've actually birthed a new center in the last several months called the Cecil Murray Center for Community Engagement, and quite blatantly trading on Chip Murray's name and reputation and moral reputation to do these sorts of things in the city. And a lot of it is about getting faith groups up to speed organizationally so that they have the capacity, the leadership, and understand the landscape and to help them do the kinds of things they want to do. So, you're absolutely right. It is a question of leadership. It's not a question so much of desire. It's a question of leadership and knowledge. And we've often talked that is, you know, if you can harness the desire into the organization and into the program knowledge and that, who knows what will ultimately happen down the line.
Yeah. Well, two of the other categories that you talk about are organizing and advocacy, and that seems to fishtail into this aspect of community development and trying to institutionalize things. So what do you mean when you're talking about religious groups responding to the 1992 riots and beyond through organization and advocacy?
Well, in organizing, there's a couple different prongs that seem to be going on. And there, first of all, there's at least one group, there are probably more than that, that developed after 1992, whether they would actually track their genesis to 1992 is a different question. That if you place them in that time frame, the landscape was open for them to develop. And so one is called CLUE, it's Clergy and Laity United for Economic Development. It's economic development anyway. And they were founded like in 1996. And then two other ones that were, and I'm going to blank on what PICO means, but PICO, P-I-C-O, which in L.A. Operates as L.A. Voice, and the IAF, the Industrial Areas Foundation, and it's called One L.A. They're slightly different, but they organize similarly, and PICO is all faith groups, and IAF includes faith groups as well as, you know, education groups and things like that. But they, PICO and IAF, they existed before 92, but they kind of weren't, had been around in the 70s and 80s, but then after 92 they reorganized and took on a new sort of newer vibrant form. But they tend to focus around policy issues like trying to get the city or county to work on living wage laws, healthcare issues, education reform, things like that, as well as to try to develop in these different communities a sort of indigenous leadership groups that can understand and can work for change within their own communities. So it's less about coming in from the outside and telling people what to do than to figure out what's going on in these communities and to help develop the leadership there and to get the kinds of things they need done in those communities. Advocacy is sort of, I find it an interesting category because it tends to cross-cut religious and political lines depending on the issue. And generally these are groups that sort of advocate, as it were, for particular kinds of policy or social kinds of changes to take place. And two of the bigger ones in the last few years have been immigration reform, and this just the one of the, I guess it's not the final because it'll probably go to the Supreme Court, but the Prop 8 stuff in California on the ability for gays to marry. And so on those two issues, you find the Catholic Church on different sides. So they're very pro-immigration reform, which paired them with groups like the Episcopal bishops, different Jewish congregations, and things like that. And then they are pro-Prop 8, which was outlawing gay marriage. So that put them in opposition to the Episcopal bishops and other groups, and then put them in league with the Mormons and some evangelical groups. So advocacy is a kind of an interesting place, and it presumably comes out of particular values, but often those values seem to be work at cross-cut, I guess I would say, traditional political lines.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the Catholics working with the Episcopals on some issues and then not with them on other issues. The last category that you talk about in terms of the activization of the faith communities in Los Angeles is interfaith dialogue. Was this something that was really not that present prior to the 1992 riots, and then a number of churches looked around and said, whoa, we got a bigger problem here that we need to cooperate on this? Or was this going on long before then? Tell us a little bit about interfaith dialogue.
Yeah, I think on interfaith dialogue, I mean, there were groups that had, there were some longstanding interfaith dialogue groups, but generally that had to do with, usually that meant prior, certainly prior to 92, and I'm not sure how far back this goes, but certainly that had to do with really kind of Jewish-Christian dialogue. That's really what it was. And sometimes Catholics were in that, depending on what group it was. But after 92, it became much more robust. It seemed like everybody was meeting with everybody, and there were meetings going on all over the place. And then groups developed. And then other things happened, like 9/11. And so then that had another impetus for groups to come together. And in this case, groups that included Muslims, and in that case, what's interesting is that the Muslim leaders themselves realized they needed to be proactive and start participating in these groups that they had previously not been that much of a part of. But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this is driven by the kind of, you know, wow, look at the kinds of things that can happen if we don't actually know each other, at least in some way. And also it's driven by just the sort of fragmentation and spread of Los Angeles. I mean, this is a perennial problem. When you say you're going to study something in Los Angeles, the definitional issue is always an issue. What do you mean by Los Angeles? Is it the city? Is it the county? Is it the region? And it's all problematic.
You
decide what you are. But and a lot of that is because there's so it's such a big and spread out area that it's hard to know what's going on everywhere.
In terms of that, and you've lived in Los Angeles. It sounds like you've grown up there. You're a surfer guy, and you definitely have been there since 1992. And I was around during the 1980s and left in 1994. What's your prognosis on how things have turned out after the 92 riots? Have all these different things, the interfaith dialogue, the advocacy, the community development, all those different aspects, has it made a positive change? Do you feel optimistic about the way things have been moving, or is there still a lot of work to be done and there's reason to be for pessimism?
I think both. I mean, I think there's a lot of optimism to be you can read a lot of optimism into the kind of development and steps that the faith community has taken in Los Angeles. One measure is, on some other projects we have, we've been in a lot of conversation with public agencies of different sorts. Almost every agency understands that it has to somehow engage the faith community. It doesn't generally, the public agencies don't generally know how to do that, but they at least acknowledge it and are recognizing they need to do that.
And that's certainly a positive step, yeah.
Pardon?
That's certainly a positive step.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways then the faith groups become an expected partner in things. Now, whether they can do things or not is a different question. And so that's sort of like I was suggesting that, you know, what we're trying to do through the Cecil Murray Center is to, you know, take the kinds of things that we can do as researchers as well as practitioners, some of the partners we have, and try to help different faith groups across religious and race and ethnic lines to be better at what they want to do. So, you know, I think in a lot of ways the faith community represents a lot of latent potential and desire, but again, lacking the organization and resources to be as successful as they could be. So people like, you know, Chip Murray and First AME and Fame Renaissance, like Community Development Corporation or things like that are the exception rather than the rule. But you could, I mean, in a theoretically, and I'm not sure, it'll be interesting to see how this works out, you know, you can develop other groups like that that may or may not approximate that in that sort of large $400 million sense, but at least they can do things in the different communities in which they're located. I think, again, returning to the sort of fragmentation of Los Angeles, and that's just the way it's been built from the beginning, is that there tend to be lots of siloed perspectives and closed networks. And a lot of times the closed networks aren't closed because of religious concerns or we don't like those people or whatever. They're just closed because they don't know people.
Right.
And so it's hard to know people. So I think that's a problem. There's a lot of people doing a lot of things, but there isn't always communication across these kinds of networks. And so I think at some point there needs to be a way, if the faith community is going to continue to be an active and positive player in the public life of Los Angeles, to know each other better and to figure out what's going on. I mean, I don't think everybody needs to reinvent the wheel. They need to figure out whatever the people are doing and where they can fit in.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems, and I want to wrap this up by wrapping around to our beginning with the question was, you know, why do people bother to go to church? And, you know, you're now seeing a lot of churches trying to be much more active in the real world. And your experience at the Biola Chapel service and young people saying, oh, I didn't know I could get beyond the bounds of Biola. And Mark Whitlock is really inspiring me. Is all this activity and from what you see from your research, giving more people a reason to get to church and to become active in their community?
Well, I think I might flip that around in a way that I think churches need to be attractive to people for the reasons that they exist in the first place, which is, I mean, if you ask any church to prioritize what they do, probably what they're always going to tell you is that they're interested in the spiritual lives of their members first, and then all this other stuff flows out of that. But I think to be able to make them an interesting and maybe provocative and engaging places for people to be, which means the pastor, which means the music, which means the community gets developed there, and then to be able to develop these sorts of services, activities, et cetera, out of that, I think is probably the way that it's always going to have to be. I mean, I think it strikes me there's a lot of places for people to do service, and one of them being churches. I think people need to have a reason to be in church for church before they're going to go out and serve off of that.
Well, I think that's a good lesson that we will take to heart here, and I want to finish up on that note. And Richard, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.